The contract ceiling amount is $4.5 billion.
A big federal contract for a Calista subsidiary. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, adding up the damage and cost of September's floods.
So far statewide, we've identified about 1,310 structures that have been impacted.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Calista, the for-profit native corporation for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, still has a board member filling in as president. But amid the controversy over current leadership, one of Calista's subsidiaries has gone on with business as usual, managing to secure a $4.5 billion federal contract. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Sophie Ivan has more.
Within days of Calista mailing out shareholder proxies for the annual meeting rescheduled for November, a press release was sent out announcing Calista Management Services' lucrative federal contract.
The contract ceiling amount is $4.5 billion. It's very significant.
That's Calista President Monica James. James says they had to compete against many large companies for the contract, which is for creating military equipment.
We were fortunate because we had the skill set, we have the past performance. The government was very pleased with Calista Management's performance, along with this positive support that we get from our parent corporation, Calista, from the financial backing, which gave us the credibility that we needed to win this contract.
Calista Aviation has joined with Science and Engineering Services Incorporated for the venture, known as the Redstone Defense System, or RDS. RDS is charged with developing rapid response hardware for the United States military. According to James, they are credited with many innovations, including the development of hardware that allows machine guns to operate in cold climates. She says they test their inventions in a prototype innovation facility.
Everything's prototype. What do you need? Okay. Our engineers go to the drawing board and they try to figure out, they bring it back to our customer and say, is this what you want? And they go through different iterations and finally everybody agrees and we go build that for the government.
One of the pieces of equipment created by RDS helps Humvees that are threatened by roadside bombs. It's called a Humvee crew extraction ring.
Our engineers invented a ring that another vehicle can clip onto that ring and pull it back on its wheels so it doesn't just sit there on its side or potentially upside down. So they're able to put the Humvee back onto the ground and get moving again.
Calista is based in Huntsville, Alabama, and has over 800 employees. James says the three-year, $4.5 billion contract comes with the option for a two-year extension. In Bethel, I'm Sophie Van.
The state's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management has identified 1,300 structures affected by September's flood disaster. As homeowners continue to slog through paperwork for disaster claims, FEMA has stepped in to join the state's recovery efforts. From member station KTNA in Talkeetna, Lorian Nettleton has more.
The state of Alaska has asked FEMA to join in a preliminary damage assessment of areas of the state affected by flooding. According to Jeremy Zydek of the Alaska Department of Homeland Security, early estimates put costs for response and damage repair at $11.9 million.
So far, statewide, we've identified about 1,310 structures that have been impacted to some degree. Now, some of them we have reports that that's major damage, and some of them just got a little bit wet. In addition, the emergency response costs and the money expended so far and the damages that we've seen so far, we estimate that those will be around $11.9 million. These are all very preliminary figures.
With FEMA as a cooperating agency, the state expects more solid numbers to determine whether to apply for federal assistance. That would double the amount available to individuals for disaster assistance grants that would help cover lost property, including vehicles, structures, damaged appliances, as well as costs for repairs.
The state's individual assistance amount is one half of what FEMA's individual assistance amount is. So if we feel that we're eligible for it, we'll apply. It will be up to the federal government to determine if we are eligible, and then that would open up additional funding for people. But right now we're still in a preliminary stage. We have to do those damage assessments in conjunction with FEMA to determine if there's enough damages.
For individuals seeking assistance, several disaster assistance locations are open this week and next around the state, and Department of Homeland Security has a hotline for anyone who can't make it to those locations. Zydek stresses that anyone who wants to make an application must do so before the November 20th deadline. In Talkeetna, I'm Lorian Nettleton.
After concerns were raised about the safety of the Drift River storage facility located at the base of Mount Redoubt, the energy company Hillcorp has started a project to ensure protection of the large oil tanks located there. But as KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, the project first needed waivers from provisions of the Redoubt Bay Critical Habitat Management Plan.
The management plan that protects the critical habitat area around Redoubt Bay was put on the books in 1994 and has specific allowances for work related to oil and gas development. In this case, Hillcorp needs materials to build up and strengthen the earthen berm that protects the 270,000-gallon tanks. Those materials, mostly gravel and dirt, come from sites within the protected area, says Bo York, the facility's engineering manager for Hillcorp.
In order to obtain our armor material to armor our earthen berms, we needed to access material site A, which involved crossing a intermittent stream that's located at the toe of the rock source. We obtained those permits, and that allows us to have our haul truck drive across, load rock, drive back across, and return to the Drift River terminal with the rock.
He says increasing the structural integrity of the storage facility is necessary, as the Drift River terminal is part of a longer-term strategy to increase production. Without that storage capacity, more tankers would have to come through Cook Inlet to pick up the oil. For public interest groups like the Cook Inlet Keeper, the simple fact that permits were properly obtained doesn't mean that the best interests of the environment are kept at the forefront. Here's Cook Inlet Keeper spokesperson Bob Shavelson.
There's this pervasive myth of rigorous permitting. The public's led to believe that there's this alphabet soup of authorizations and permits, and that industry complies with all these requirements, that you're going to somehow protect salmon habitat, and that's patently false. And you can see it in this instance, where they're going to be filling and driving across a salmon stream so they can mine rock from a critical habitat area where Fish and Game's own rules prohibit mining in that area.
York says the stream in question was identified by Fish and Game as anadromous, and that Hillcorp has designed its project, which includes an access ramp across the stream, with appropriate protections in place. Paul Blanche is a habitat biologist for Fish and Game. He says the unnamed stream in question is located in an area that sees regular changes in hydrology.
The stream is fed by many low-volume waterfalls and other surface and groundwater inputs from the adjacent 800-foot cliff. And our impression, based on the geology and the multiple waterfall inputs, is that the system is somewhat flashy during precipitation events and likely has very low flow during the winter.
The Redoubt Bay Critical Habitat Management Plan forbids materials extraction unless there are extenuating circumstances for which no feasible alternative is available. In a letter to Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell, Shavelson argued that a possible alternative for Hillcorp would be to barge in the large rock they need for construction. The proposed material site sits just 6 miles south of the Drift River Terminal. Shavelson maintains that the best alternative would be to do away with the terminal altogether and construct an oil pipeline beneath Cook Inlet.
The State Department of Fish and Game is allowing them to violate Fish and Game's own rules to mine these boulders to resume storing oil at the base of an active volcano, which is the stupidest place that you can store oil that I can think of. And it's been borne out time and time again, yet here we go, bending the rules and breaking the rules so industry can get off cheaper. The best way to get that oil across the inlet is to pipeline it across.
Chavelson isn't the only one who sees an oil pipeline as a safer way into the future. This summer, the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council released a position paper stating its support for a pipeline, which has been backed by other energy companies operating in Cook Inlet. From Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The deadline to register to vote in next month's general election is this Sunday, October 7th. Regional election offices in the state's larger cities will be open on Saturday and Sunday for those completing registrations in person. Registration forms can be downloaded from the state website and faxed to the Division of Elections as well. Anyone updating or completing a new voter registration after Sunday will have to vote with a question ballot on Election Day. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a dare for Sitkins.
We should all gather down at Sheldon Jackson College and strip down to nothing but our boots and run through the street saying bye to the tourists.
Oh my, that's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
A 45-year-old Kiana man accused of shooting two men north of his village has pleaded not guilty to charges of attempted murder and other counts. Teddy Kyle Smith was arraigned today in Nome. Assistant District Attorney John Hayes says trial was set for January. He says Smith remains held on $500,000 bail. In addition to attempted murder, Smith faces charges of theft, robbery, weapons misconduct, and assault in connection with the September 18th shooting of 46-year-old Paul Buckell of Kotzebue and 47-year-old Charles Buckell of Fostoria, Michigan, at a remote cabin. Alaska State Troopers have said the brothers are recovering. Troopers say the brothers found Smith at the cabin and were shot after an altercation. Smith went missing earlier in September after his mother died. An 18-year-old Homer High School football player and his older brother have been accused of sexually assaulting a boy passed out at a party. 18-year-old Joseph Resiteris and 20-year-old Anthony Resiteris were arrested yesterday by Alaska State Troopers. Homer school officials say the younger brother was kicked off the team. A criminal complaint filed in Homer Superior Court says troopers were alerted to the sexual assault by a hospital nurse on September 10th after the boy attended a large teen drinking party 2 days earlier. The complaint says the boy passed out and Anthony Resiteris sexually assaulted him while Joseph Resiteris also participated. Troopers recovered multiple photos from the party, including of the rape. Troopers say there could be additional charges as the investigation continues. The Two Rivers Dog Mushers Association, or TRDMA, will not participate in the International Federation of Sled Dog Sports World Championships next March. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the association made the final determination during their monthly meeting earlier this week.
The International Federation of Sled Dog Sports, or IFSS, subscribed to the World Anti-Doping Code in 2008 with the goal of gaining Olympic recognition. But the rules include a list of banned substances mushers use regularly for dog care. There are also limitations on the extent to which mushers can provide care for their dogs during IFSS races. Two Rivers 200 Race Committee Chair Scott Chesney says that's why the TRDMA has decided to stick to their original decision.
This is the final decision. We will not be associating ourselves with the IFSS World Championship long distance races.
The IFSS asked the International Sled Dog Veterinary Medical Association to make recommendations about rule changes during their annual meeting last weekend, but Chesney says he's not sure much came of that request.
From the emails that I've gotten, I've been able to determine it looks like they asked the ISDVMA to form a committee to explore that option. So that tells me that nothing's going to change.
Officials with the IFSS haven't confirmed the formation of a committee, but Chesney says with snow starting to fly, timing is such that any changes or exemptions to the race rules will likely come too late.
There's got to be considerable logistics involved with bringing a team over from Europe or Russia or wherever they're coming from, and if they, you know, tell them if they can't decide until December or January, you know, that's not being fair to them.
North Pole Economic Development Corporation Executive Director Buzz Otis says while he's disappointed in the outcome, he's not upset about the process.
You know, we're establishing a relationship with Two Rivers Dog Mushers Association that didn't exist in the past. And, you know, I think only positive things will come of this.
The Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau estimates the IFSS World Championship could bring up to $1.1 million in revenue to the borough. Otis says he's not sure what the effect might be should the long-distance event be canceled. There are currently four teams signed up to mush in the distance race. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The state of Alaska wants to participate in a legal challenge of National Park Service authority. The case involves a run-in between a moose hunter and park rangers on the Yukon River that generated major tensions. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Department of Law is seeking status as an amicus or friend of the court in a case filed by Central resident Jim Wild. Wild is appealing a misdemeanor conviction stemming from his refusal to cooperate with Yukon Charley National Park Rangers during a boat safety check on the Yukon River in 2010. The U.S. Constitution grants navigable waters to states, and Wild's appeal challenges NPS authority to regulate rivers like the Yukon inside federal park boundaries. The state initially shied away from the Wild case last year, citing its criminal nature, but Assistant Attorney General Ann Nelson says it had a change of heart based in part on the brief filed by Wild's attorney.
It raises issues regarding the relationship to other litigation that's involved subsistence use of state-owned navigable waters. So we're not a party in the Wild case, but we will be filing a brief with the court that explains the state's position.
Wild's attorney, Bill Satterberg of Fairbanks, says he's pleased the state has changed its mind. Satterberg expects briefing in the Wild case to be completed by the end of the year. Nelson says the state also reconsidered the case because the federal court is looking at consolidating all cases involving federal authority on navigable waters, including another one the state is involved in. John Sturgeon, an Anchorage hunter banned by the Park Service from using a hovercraft on Yukon Charley waters, filed a challenge that Nelson says the state is party to.
You know, we've been affected by the Park Service applying those regulations to the state, specifically to the Department of Fish and Game, requiring that they get permits in order to conduct research in state-owned navigable waters within national parks.
Federal courts have ruled that the Park Service has authority under the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution to regulate state waters inside national parks. Nelson says the legal situation in Alaska is different because the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act additionally curbs federal authority. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Ross.
Absentee and faxed ballots have changed the outcome of the mayoral race for the city and borough of Wrangell. Donald McConaughey Sr. picked up 8 faxed votes during the canvassing process yesterday, enough to erase David L. Jack's 5-vote lead after Tuesday's election. Jack, also an assembly member, picked up 1 vote in yesterday's canvass. Deputy Clerk Carol Bean says the final tally was 303-301 in McConaughey's favor. The count is final, and results will be certified Monday.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, saying goodbye to summer. In Southeast Alaska, the last cruise ship visit is as much a signal of the seasons changing as the weather. And in Sitka, the residents have created something of a ritual to mark the season's end. KCAW's Ed Ronco has the story.
Under a shelter at Sitka's Crescent Harbor, people are beginning to gather in costumes. The Statue of Liberty is here, a lumberjack, a group of kids dressed as a bouquet of flowers, and then there's Jude Rice. She is wearing multicolored boots that say peace and nature.
And then I have some kind of Hawaiian bright red pants on with colorful, different colored flowers. I'm a flower child, you know.
And above that is a tie-dye t-shirt.
Oh, yes, and then to top it all off, I have this multicolored, brightly colored, wiggy, curly thing.
This is the running of the boots. Sitkins gather at Crescent Harbor and, wearing their rubber boots, run the length of downtown and back. It all began in 1995. Resident Sheila Finkenbinder was listening to a show on KCAW. It was playing Spanish music, and the host, who now happens to be the station's general manager, was talking about the running of the bulls in Pamplona, Spain.
And so he said, you know, we should have a running of the boots here in Sitka, and we should all gather down at Sheldon Jackson College and strip down to nothing but our boots and run through the street saying goodbye to the tourists.
Finkenbinder took the idea and, forgive me, ran with it, mostly.
But we didn't strip down. We did wild and crazy outfits instead, and so here it is.
Nobody had the courage to run naked.
They've gotten very close. Very close.
Fair enough.
Yeah, bikinis, flags, yeah.
But nobody's gone the full Monty.
No, and I don't know how well that would go over here.
Yeah, and it's cold.
And it's cold. Sometimes it's warm. You got to agree. Once in a while, we have beautiful sunny days. So it sounds like they're about ready to take off.
And indeed they are. The runners have lined up in a parking lot, costumes flapping in the breeze, and with a countdown and the tossing of a boot, they're off. Nobody's running a stopwatch or anything. The Boston Marathon, this is not. But it doesn't take long for the first runner to cross the finish line.
I am William the Giant.
William the Giant. His real name, we checked. Giant is 5'6", and his legs and feet are covered in beige and brown paint to look like the familiar extra tough boots. That's because Giant ran this race barefoot.
It doesn't feel all that great.
How long did it take you to get used to it?
Probably I've been doing it for about a month only to really run on pavement, but I mostly like to run in grass and on the tracks because it's really, really fun.
Why?
Why?
I think people are going to be listening to this going, why?
Well, it builds a lot of calf and foot strength that you need for running even in shoes, but it's just, it feels great like out on the trails, but it's hard to get strong enough for those trails without running on some other stuff first.
The paint, by the way, was done by his partner, Tess Giant.
And you are not barefoot.
I'm not barefoot, no. I think that's crazy.
The running of the boots went off as scheduled this year, celebrating a tourism season that ended a little earlier than expected. The last two ships bound for Sitka, each carrying about 2,000 passengers, canceled their port calls. The culprit, bad weather. That happens from time to time, thanks to Sitka's geography on the outside of the Inside Passage. Forecasts for what was supposed to be Sitka's last week of tourism called for seas near 20 feet. But there's not much talk of flagging visitor numbers or high seas today.
Oh, this is just, this is so Sitka. You know, this is like the ultimate in fun.
That is Jude Rice again, the woman with the multicolored wig. She's been coming to the running of the boots for years and years.
Years and years and years and years, and I have never run, and I've never entered the costume contest. So this year I got to run, well, walk. And I got a prize for being the most colorful character.
And she says this is as much a celebration of Sitka's full-time colorful characters as it is a farewell to the ones who come ashore for the day. For AK, I'm Ed Ronco in Sitka.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're going way up north to the village of Koktovik inside the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The community of about 300 people is located on the north shore of Barter Island on the Beaufort Sea.
My name is Annie Tikluk. I'm the city of Koktovik mayor for the village of Koktovik. What's Koktovik like? It's welcoming village. They have the biggest hearts in this village. They're very nice on welcoming anybody and everybody into the village. This time of the year, right now, they're doing our fall whaling. They've caught one, and they're still trying to get one couple of more. Yeah, there's quite a bit of tourists that fly into our village and come and view the polar bears. Polar bears, they are, well, they're pretty smart animals. They are waiting around on Spinard Spit right by Barter Island. The most they count was 76, and they're just sunbathing on Spinard Spit waiting for a whale to come in. What do people do for fun? Well, let's see. We gather around certain places and play fun card games. If they're not playing card games, they're out visiting with each other, and if anything, they get together and jam out with instruments. Work right now, we just got done with a road project, and that was how many months long, so that was a good income for a lot of families here in our village. How beautiful it is. Oh, it's really, really beautiful. I mean, you get to see everything. We get to see animals on the island and off the island. Can't say nothing bad about this village. We're so lucky to have everything here.
Annie Teekluk is the mayor of Koktovik. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ed Ronco and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Sophie Evan in Bethel, Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Dave Waldron was our AK guest host this week. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge would create a second link between the Matsu and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.